I think parties rarely go wrong by having a broader range of both defensive and offensive targets.
Nate, would you say you miss 100% of the shots you don't take?
You miss 100% of the shots that you don't take. Wayne Gretzky, folks.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. As of Monday morning, deaths from COVID-19 in the United States stand at nearly 80,000, with death projections increasing as states reopen. Right now, all but a dozen states are in some stage of reopening, and the influential model out of the University of Washington is now projecting around 140,000 deaths by August, which is up significantly from its initial projection. The White House has rejected a reopening plan from the CDC, according to the New York Times, and floated winding down its coronavirus task force before backtracking. So with unemployment nearly at 15% nationally, the focus for some is on reviving the economy, but the threat of the virus is still a concern for many, and it's even made its way into as secure a workplace as the White House. So at this point, the question, both practically and politically, is, what is the plan for handling the coronavirus pandemic going forward? Today, we're going to tackle that question, and we're also going to take our first look at the race for control of the Senate this fall. And here with me to do that, of course, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, everybody.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hey, Micah.
Hello. Hey, everybody.
All right. So before we get to the issue of reopening and the politics surrounding it, let's ask one of our favorite questions, which is good use of polling or bad use of polling. And today's example comes courtesy of the New York Times. Based on a survey they conducted with Morning Consult, they wrote this headline, quote, "Nearly half of men say they do most of the homeschooling, period. 3% of women agree," end of quote. So the survey explored how families are dealing with the new realities of pandemic life. You may have seen this headline. It made its rounds. So some conflicting perceptions going on there. We can dig into what happens when we get conflicting views of reality in a poll. But first off, is this a good use of polling or bad use of polling?
It's a great use of headlining, for sure.
Great headline. That's true. It is a great headline.
Shouts to the New York Times copy desk.
Okay, so tell me more. Is it behind the headline, is a good use of polling?
I mean, yeah, not to sound like a Miss Marple character, but like with this, I sort of felt where there's smoke, there's fire. Even if we're not getting the most, you know, it's people's perceptions, but the difference between men's and women's perceptions of work being done is so drastic that it kind of makes you think there's something going on here.
There's also, as the article mentions, there's a long history of research showing that men overestimate the amount of work they do around the house. So this kind of fits in with that. It seems like, the gap is stark. I think that's what's most shocking. But it seems it was a really interesting finding.
Yeah. I mean, we often rely on polls to help us understand the world here at 538. So what do we do with the information that, at least in this case, someone isn't telling the pollster the truth, I guess, right? I mean, is it fair to say that?
Well, that's...
Or they think...
Yeah, I don't think they're lying. I think they're delusional. I mean, have we not learned that about people?
Yeah.
You know, I'm 42 years old. I think people lie sometimes, but I think people are far more deluded than they are dishonest.
Okay.
Yeah.
That seems like, is that an optimistic view of human nature or pessimistic? I don't know.
The one, I do think it's mostly people are delusional, although, you know, you can imagine some kind of social pressure to tell an outside person, oh yeah, I'm doing the housework. So maybe there's a little bit of fudging going on here too. The other question I had is about the question itself, which was, who is spending more time homeschooling your children or helping them with distance learning? And actually, when I first read that question, I thought it meant, since the pandemic started, are you spending more time doing this? So I don't know if that maybe messed up the results, or I'm the only person who read it that way originally.
Sounds charitable,
maybe the actual
Micah.
Question. Yeah, well, maybe I'm a typical man, and I just we men and women read the question differently. I don't think that's true, but
well, I actually really love this piece, and Claire Kane Miller, who wrote this story, in addition to having a great name, albeit one that's spelled incorrectly, is just really
so good.
Great. No, but she's so good. I love all of her stuff, and this article. I mean, obviously, it has these really stark polling numbers, but then it really tries to dig into why this is happening. And there's a quote from a sociology professor, Kathleen Gerson at NYU, who says, you know, one of the reasons why perhaps women, especially right now, are doing more work. And she says, quote, to say he does more of it is to say I'm not a good mother. And I think that's such an interesting thing, right? All of this cuts to what even professional, you know, high earning women think that they should be doing. And it's so much of where expectations in a relationship and in child rearing are set from the very beginning. You know, I think there's a stat in here that couples who take equal time off or both take time off at the birth of their child are more likely to share more of the workload of child rearing as they go forward. I think this is, I mean, you can look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics has these really interesting household duties numbers that I've looked at before, you know, how Americans spend their leisure time, and women overwhelmingly spend more of their quote unquote leisure time doing household work. And it's this thing that it's so, I mean, we can get into a whole conversation about cooking having become the sort of like bougie person's hobby has a little bit like gender neutralized some of the, you know, the homemaking conversation in America. But still, I would say the overwhelming number of people I know who are hobbyist cooks are women, right? And it almost gives this interesting like veneer of like, oh, it's like a cool hobby to have rather than like, oh, I just do all the cooking in our house and I'm the woman, right? So there's like lots of really interesting meaty stuff in here, but I did find the probable delusion of the American men surveyed in here really, really interesting.
Are there other cases where pollsters ask respondents questions and the information that we get, whether they're telling the pollster the truth or not, like seems delusional? And what do we do with that information? I mean, usually we're just asking people who they personally support or, you know, what they personally think of the economy or whatever. I guess in some cases, people may be delusional about what they think about the economy given their own partisanship. But are there any other areas of polling that we can relate this to?
I mean, I think the lesson I talked about earlier is like people actually are pretty honest in polls. And there are times when you have to be careful because there might be so-called social desirability bias where you want to say something which you think will elicit more approval from the actual person you're being interviewed by if it's a phone interview. But these are not super large effects for the most part. They become relevant at certain times and places. But yeah, I'm sure if you ask kind of, you know, I don't know if there's actually been a poll. I'm sure there has. If you ask people, are you an above average driver? I'm sure that way more than 50% say yes.
There's probably a gender gap on that one too. And how people rate their driving performances. The other one, Galen, though, or one of the more prominent examples of what you're asking about is when you ask people who they voted for in the last election, the share of people who say they voted for the winner is usually higher than the share that actually voted for the winner. So a lot of people will
that is
will you know, I think to Nate's point, I don't think most people are lying. I think a lot of people don't remember, or they just say, oh yeah, I supported the winner. So it is a reminder that like a lot of survey research, you are dependent on people, and people are fallible and delusional and crazy and all the other things, you know?
All right. That is a fun note to begin this podcast on. So we rated that great headline. We also give
well, not fun for
polling.
The women of America.
Good use of polling.
Delusional use
of men.
I feel like we could end every segment that way. Just Claire going, well, not fun for the women of America.
That's our new segment.
That's our new segment. Things that are, yeah, anyway. All right, let's move on to the politics of reopening. And let's begin where we have been over the past, 2 months, which is checking in on where cases and deaths stand, just to get an overall sense of where America is in the course of this crisis. So last week, Nate, you said that we should stop thinking in terms of a national peak. And then it looked like the numbers were kind of plateauing nationally. And part of that is that, different parts of the country are experiencing the pandemic to a greater or lesser extent at different times. So is that still the case? Does it still look like we're at a plateau in America?
I think there's actually been some positivity in the numbers over the past week, more so than we were taking this a week ago. And I think that goes against, I'm going to have a lot of moments like this, right? So I just want to say, I think because this discussion about how is coronavirus going has become so politicized that people are not looking at the data with sometimes the nuance and subtlety that it requires. One important thing the U.S. has done is to substantially increase the amount of testing that we've done. It's roughly doubled within a few weeks. So if you look at the raw case counts, then there's a little bit of a decline, but outside of New York, not much, right? If you look at the rate of positive tests, though, it's fallen quite a bit. It's been around 8% in recent days. That's down from a peak of around 20 or 22%. If you exclude New York, where it's really, really, really fallen, you've gone from a peak of around 16% to now 8%. So that does show progress. And the U.S. has, again, people would say we need more testing. I would agree with that assessment. If we doubled tests again in a month and then again in the next month, that might start to get us to a point where it would be a lot better. But the fact is that, if you are only detecting roughly 1 in 10 cases, which is what public health officials largely think, that's a consensus, right? Then there's this kind of great opportunity to find more cases when you do more tests. We want to do more tests and therefore detect a higher percentage of cases. And so I think the conversation is a little bit off, and that people kind of assume that it's hopeless and we should maybe just give up, when in fact there are signs of progress. And do differ across different states and regions. So some regions that are trouble spots are the Midwest, kind of everywhere in the Midwest except maybe Michigan, which had a bad outbreak originally. People are more careful. There are problems in the Midwest with keeping the numbers from going down, right? They're kind of flat or increasing in some states. And then the D.C., Maryland, Virginia, Delaware, Mid-Atlantic region. I think it's actually, I'm not trying to be funny, I think it's not totally a coincidence that you've had a flare-up of cases in the White House this week, because D.C. is actually now producing as many new cases a day as anywhere, more new cases per day, new cases, not total cases, but new ones than New York. So look, I think there are signs of slow progress in most parts of the country, signs of rapid progress in some parts of the country, and then there are some places where there's no progress or there's regress, where things are getting worse. But overall, I think the conversation is a little miscalibrated, because people are the same people who scream, oh, we need to test, we need to test, right? Then you do more tests, you find more cases because you're doing more testing, and they're like, oh my God, this is terrible, we're never getting out of this. It's like, you want to do more tests because you'll find more cases that way, and you have to adjust for the number of tests that you do when writing at all about case counts, or else you're really misinforming people. And it's like, we've been screaming about this for 2 months,
all right,
and it's kind of driving me crazy, I have to say.
So clearly worked up about that. But there's a question also here, because we are entering somewhat of a new phase of handling this crisis, which is that economies or states are beginning the reopening process. And of course, it looks different in different states. And it's not like people are just going back to theme parks and concerts. People are still being pretty careful. And we're also going to have to wait 2 to 3 weeks to understand what the effects of those changes are. But at this point, can we say, from a national perspective, from the Trump administration's perspective, what is the plan going forward? We were shut down for a while. We were all following the socially distancing guidelines from the White House, etc. At this point, what is the plan from the top?
There is no plan.
Yeah, I mean, it's the CDC guidelines that were approved by the CDC, but then suppressed by the White House and then reported by the AP at the beginning of this weekend, are not coming out under the approval of the White House. The White House apparently has, I think the White House is almost reverting to, let's be more hands-off in how we tell people to go back to work. So there's some speculation that they are getting pushback from, you know, people like Purdue, right? The meat processing people. There's speculation and reporting that people who are concerned with religious liberty don't want the government to tell people how to go back to church, for instance. And so there's this kind of vacuum, for lack of a better word, in how to actually treat reopening. There's not guidance from the highest levels of the government about how Americans should go about this. I wrote about this a little bit right before the Trump inauguration, but it was about suppression of data that governments have done in the past. And I kind of feel like the CDC report not coming out is a bit, you know, it has a lot in common with the politicization of data that we've seen in places like the EPA and stuff like that, where it's suppressing, you know, medical or scientific guidelines for political purposes. So I don't know. It's a bit of a morass.
Yeah. Does everyone agree?
I mean, there's no plan. There's like literally no plan, right?
So yes, Nate agrees.
Look, I think there's a de facto kind of plan. I mean, states have plans, right? You know, states are basically going to ratchet up reopening a little bit at a time and see how much the numbers go up, if at all, right? That's the plan. And to some extent, that's what Europe's doing too, right? The question is like, what things do you reopen? How well are you measuring this? How strict are your standards, right? Let's say things are flat. Will you tolerate flat or do you want them to decrease? Obviously, it seems like red states are being a little bit more aggressive, but as clear as you, and who was the other fellow you wrote the article with, wrote about, right?
Kyle Barassa.
Claire and Kyle wrote, people's behavior is actually kind of only loosely tied to whether things are formally reopened or not. So in some sense, people are all kind of voting with their feet because you can't compel people to go out in public if they don't want to. And frankly, you can't really prevent them from socializing if they do want to. Look, I still think it's the case that like there is a lot of people dipping their toes in the water. And it's kind of a natural human reaction to an environment where there's danger that is perceived to be uncertain, although perhaps receding. I still think people maybe are making a mistake to assume that there are going to be big spikes. I mean, there may be some, right? But people are going to be a lot more careful, even in reopening states, than they were in the pre-kind of COVID days, just staying home when you're sick and washing hands, and people should wear masks if they're in crowded spaces. That stuff can all help, right? I don't know. I don't think we're going to see necessarily, like, I think there are a lot of people who, like, literally you'll see. And by the way, one of the problems with this pandemic is we all spend too much time, even more than usual, on the internet and social media and whatever else, right? You'll sometimes see, okay, here is a picture of people not social distancing in X county, and just look at the case statistics in 3 weeks, and it's going to shoot way up, right? And actually, it doesn't actually do that all that often. The relationships are noisy. The data is noisy and imperfect. We're often depicting behavior that a small minority of people do, and assuming that's kind of typical, right? And also, there are various steps people are taking that can help suppress the coronavirus, right? Like wearing masks is potentially important. There are some effects from the weather that may be helpful. There are some effects from shifting activity from indoors to outdoors that may be helpful.
One thing that we've been talking about a lot, I think, internally is, and there's certainly a lot of discussion of it politically, is the normalization of the super high death rate and the idea that what politicians are now playing with is, you know, who are the acceptable deaths, or what are the acceptable numbers of deaths? And I think that's such a striking political conversation to be having. I mean, Nate, I keep on thinking about something you said back when, right after Trump won, I think, where you said, you know, we could wake up one day and the sky is bright red and it would be weird for 2 weeks and then it would all become normal to us. And I do think that's sort of happening right now with these high numbers of deaths, right? How many people have died of coronavirus? 75,000 in the United States?
Yeah, it's
something like that.
As of this morning, the last time I checked, it was 79,500. So it'll probably be 80,000 or more by the time people listen to this.
Right. So I think that's been in the reopening conversation, that's really the underlying thing of all of this, right? Is, and I don't know a good way to say this other than inevitably there will be deaths that will occur because the country, conservative or not conservative, will have to open up and go back to work, right? This is just like, it's sort of like the thing we don't want to talk about. But what America is really having a conversation about is, what are the acceptable deaths? And who are the acceptable deaths? And I think that that's a really tough conversation to have.
I mean, are we on our way there already? Does it seem like some daily death rate between 1,000 and 3,000 is just going to become normalized and become background noise? Or does that not happen in American social and political life? Do people continue to... I mean, how much is it up to the media whether or not that happens? Or how much is it up to just people's fatigue? What does this look like going forward?
I think it's partly up to the media, certainly. But I also think I wouldn't necessarily jump to the idea that it'll become background noise. You know, Trump's approval rating for his handling of coronavirus has been trending down essentially ever since the U.S. surpassed 10,000 deaths from coronavirus, right? Which we know is probably an undercount. Now, because everything is partisan, you don't see huge swings, right? It hasn't gone down 50 points, but it's been trending down. So I would imagine that if for the next few months or longer, you know, 2,000, 3,000 people a day are dying, that will not be good for Trump politically, to say the least. The other thing is, like, you know, it's not just the number of people who have died, right? It's his actual handling of it and how the states are handling it. You know, as Claire wrote about, people stopped moving around before the stay-at-home orders came down. And if you look at the timeline, it kind of roughly coincides with a few things. This is what Claire pointed this out. You know, it coincided with the NBA canceling its season. It coincided with the WHO declaring it a pandemic. It didn't coincide really with anything the president did. Now, in that case, it happened to be for the best. The public, you know, reading those signals, I think, was ahead of the political leadership. But I'm not sure there's any guarantee that those signals will point in the right direction this time,
yeah.
You know? And so,
yeah, I think, and just to give context to that story, Kyle Barassa, who is an academic who came to us with sort of this interesting movement data that sort of showed where Americans were moving, you know, in the last couple of months. So it shows more people staying at home far before governors said we should have stay-at-home orders. What I'm really interested in is, now that we're fully in this conversation of reopening the country, what that data will show now, right? Are people, if in the very beginning people were just, you know, super scared about the virus and the unknowns, they were seeing everything shut down, they decided to stay home. Okay, now we have 2 months of staying at home. We have the summer, you know, the warm weather beckoning. We have the president and a lot of governors either vocally or tacitly saying, yeah, we're going to reopen. How many people are going to stay at home, right? Or how many people are going to say, I got to leave the house? And I think those numbers, to me, are, I have no idea. You know, I think that people do have real fatigue about staying at home and have an inability to conceptualize 6 more months, let alone 2 more months of the same thing. So I think those are a big question mark to me.
I agree with that, Claire. And actually, a couple polls came out today that seem to show. So for the last few weeks, the majority of Americans, clear majorities, have been more concerned about reopening too quickly than reopening not quickly enough. A couple of polls actually came out today, which seemed to show those numbers shifting a bit towards, okay, let's reopen now. Just a bit, not huge movement, right? So I wonder, Claire, so what signals does the public read, basically? They get antsy, people want to get out, the weather starts to get nice. Trump and a lot of governors are saying, okay, it's time to reopen. At the same time, though, there's like a COVID outbreak in the White House, basically. And so what signal does that send? But I don't know. I hope I hope whatever signals the public does read, they get it right. You know, it's kind of anxiety inducing.
I mean, look, I do feel like there's a school of thought that, like, well, you know, who really cares if it's 1,000 deaths per day or 3,000? Those are both still really bad, and they are, but also one is three times worse than the other, right? And I do think people are going to make decisions that are based on how many people they know are getting sick and how many people they know are dying or are in critical condition, right? And to some extent, the disease itself is more powerful than any plans we might set up, and that will kind of dictate activity. I think right now you see, support for lockdown measures. So three things, right? Number one, it's still high. Number two, it's coming down a bit. Number three, it's actually becoming a little bit more partisan, where it's fallen a little bit among Democrats, but a lot among Republicans, support for lockdown type measures. You know, and there are going to be, I mean, there clearly is like something now where, okay, where liberals see certain things as virtuous and conservatives see them as kind of inappropriate or prudish, maybe. You know what I mean? And that's kind of, there's a moral dimension here to the way these debates occur. And that's important to keep in mind.
And there's the other part of the debate, which is a real one, which is economic deaths, for lack of a better term, right? How many people who were, you know, homeless or already living on, you know, the edge of financial stability could be really, you know, not just financially affected, but life or death affected by the economy, right? That is a real, that is a factor in all of this as well. And something that I think people, you know, the economic deaths.
I mean, in some ways, you know, first of all, on the one hand, society makes trade-offs all the time, right? Imagine that coronavirus were 10 times less deadly, okay? Then it really is flu-like as far as the death rates. If it's 10 times less deadly than it actually is. And then we kind of know what happens when we deal with the flu, right? There are at most very minor measures. Now imagine that, like, coronavirus is Ebola. It's 10 times more deadly, or more than that, I think, actually, for Ebola. 20 times more deadly if you catch it. Okay, we're under martial law, right? There's no question whatsoever that we're as locked down as we can until we get a vaccine or cases down to zero. So, you know, we are in the range where there are a lot of hard choices to be made, and you can detect that based on based on the fact that different countries are making these choices in different ways, and we don't seem to be making any kind of choice at all. But it's not inappropriate to assess trade-offs. And it's not just economic trade-offs. It's also like, you know, people are not going to school. People are not seeing their loved ones, right? People are not seeing their friends. People are doing a lot of things that might be damaging to their quality of life. And those are things that also are part of the calculation. But the other complicated part of this all is that, like, there are things that might involve kind of the marshmallow test, right? You know what that is, where famous psychological experiment where, you know, if you can avoid eating the one marshmallow now, then you get two marshmallows later, right? There are some things where if we take more steps now to be cautious, that might mean we actually get more stuff back in the fall, right? And so I don't know. It's just like there are like three or four different framings, and it's just very complicated. And I you know, I come down on the side of someone who says that we should keep parts of the lockdown in place longer now while there still is political support for it.
Nate's a hold off, get more marshmallows later kind of guy.
Kind of guy, yeah. But is
America that kind of country?
Is it fair to say that at this point we as a nation have given up on the advice that most public health experts have given us of stay in lockdown mode until cases get low enough that you can test and contact trace whatever cases occur, and then you kind of treat this on a case-by-case basis instead of there's some sort of plateau and there are going to be daily deaths, but that's just part of life in America now. Like, have we rejected that? Are some states pursuing it and not others? Like, are we beyond the advice from public health experts now?
Yeah. I mean,
no.
No.
Go ahead, Micah. Then I'll argue back.
I mean,
yeah.
I, I'm not sure we've decided not to do it, but there's been a lack of decision in certain places, as we've talked about. I mean, to go back to the marshmallows, I don't think President Trump is a, hey, I'll get more marshmallows later type of guy. So just naturally, I think there's been a lack of kind of like crisp decision making that you would need, I think, to follow that course, and that we've seen in other countries. You know, I think it was a Tom Friedman column, which I hesitate to cite, but he was talking about, you know, okay, you could reopen things, and this is what Sweden did, I think. You could reopen things and help the vulnerable, right? Just you know, reopening is going to feed the pandemic to some extent. So you pour a lot of resources into supporting the people who will be most exposed to that, in terms of health, economically. We're not really doing that in as decisive a way. So I think the lack of a clear plan inherently means we've not chosen that path that you're describing, Galen.
Nate, you disagreed.
Well, so look, I disagree in a couple of maybe fairly subtle ways, right? You know, number one is I think part of the issue is that there is not unanimity among public health experts. I think they are generally on the side of keeping things more shut down for longer. But I think there is far from unanimity, ranging from people, like if you actually read the original Imperial College report, right, that actually said, okay, we may need lockdowns for 18 months until there's a vaccine with periodic lifting them, right? That's probably not the consensus view. Then there are some countries that are saying, you know what, we just need to mitigate risks. We're not really going to be able to suppress it anyway for 18 months, so let's just protect the vulnerable. And that's kind of the other pole of this, right? But there is almost every kind of point in that spectrum in between, from Sweden on the one hand to 18-month lockdown on the other hand. You can find plenty of experts at almost any point within that consensus. And so that makes things more complicated, right? And also, you know, there's a question of kind of which, I don't know how to put this. I think sometimes when public health experts and epidemiologists are talking to the media, they want to make sure that people are not getting any bad ideas, and they tend to be extremely careful and cautious, maybe a bit more so than if you gave them truth serum and asked them for what their private opinion is, because they realize that, like, the White House and people will kind of spin things in a certain way, and other people will spin things in a different way, right? And so, you know, but I think that also means that, like, probably privately, there's a little bit less consensus than you might get kind of publicly from public health experts. So it's kind of confusing. I also think the country is doing okay with some things. I mean, look, major parts of society are still shut down in many states. The big super spreading type stuff, like travel and conferences and sporting events and political rallies, either are not happening, or in the case of travel, I can go to the airport and get in a flight today if I want. Very few people are doing that, right? So, like, there is actually,
right?
Like,
but how long will that last, though? I mean, you've got Trump himself saying, "I'd like to ramp up my rallies come June," and yeah, we'd like to still have the RNC the Republican National Convention happen. I mean, there are also ways where things could get very. I don't know. I'm just bringing this up as, like, this is not necessarily going to be the way things are for very long.
No, look, I mean, there is, but look, the fatigue is real because people are making real sacrifices, right? We're not nearly, at least not in most of the country, we're not nearly back to normal life. And I think people don't necessarily have an expectation to get back to normal life. And I guess, like, part of what I'm saying is, like, there is a lot of conversation and activity that's happening around the margins, right? Do we go from marginally more closed to marginally more open? Either way, we're nowhere near truly locked down. I mean, if you look at what happened in Wuhan or Italy, way more severe than any state had here. And we're nowhere near truly oblivious and open, right? So we're talking about kind of marginal effects and marginal choices that over time could become much more major, right? But like, there is a little bit of kind of needles on pinheads about like, okay, well, can this particular type of business type open with these particular precautions? And then some small fraction of the regular customers would come to that business, right? I mean, the problem is like it all boils down to like these extremely marginal decisions that we have to make in every literally aspect of our daily lives, right? But people expect there to be big blow-ups or unambiguous data, and that's kind of not the way the world works. The collective sum of marginal decisions often results in very noisy and messy evidence of kind of what effects that has.
Yeah, I think that's a really good kind of perspective to have on all of this, and I'm glad it's one that we can talk about more openly here on this podcast. There were some other things that I wanted to get to in this segment that I think we're not going to have time to get to, but we will have time in future episodes. Coronavirus isn't going anywhere, so we can talk about more of the politics and calculations that Trump is making, the unemployment rate, you know, how the economy will affect all of this. We'll get to that in the future, but I do want to move on and talk about the Senate because we have some new polling. So let's do that. Of the 35 Senate seats up for election this fall, Republicans are defending 23 of them. And in order to flip control of the chamber, Democrats would need to gain a net total of 3 or 4 seats, depending on who the vice president is, of course, since the VP is the tie-breaking vote. Lately, Republican strategists have been telling reporters they're worried about defending the Senate. Polling has been backing up those worries. So this is our first foray into the race for the Senate on this podcast, and we will come back to it. This will be somewhat brief. But from the start, at this moment, which party is favored to win the Senate this fall and why? Jump ball.
It is a jump ball, maybe.
We don't have a model, so I don't have a view, but it's obviously competitive. Sorry.
Yeah,
we don't
have
a model,
okay,
so I don't have a view.
Well, yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe what we can say
is truth serum, Nate.
The fact that we're having this conversation and that it's difficult to say which party has a super clear advantage is a different conversation than I think we would have expected to have 6 to 8 months ago or something.
Yeah.
What, tell me more. What do you mean?
When the Republicans were clearly favored, to finish the thought.
Yeah, there definitely has been movement over the past several weeks towards Democrats. I think you've seen that a little bit in the generic ballot. You've seen it in the Biden-Trump polls. You've seen it in a variety of state-level Senate polling. And that movement, the way I would put it is like, the map, because Republicans are defending so much territory this year, the map is sort of the inverse of what it was in 2018 when Democrats were defending a ton of seats. But because Republicans are defending so many seats, it's very easy for, if there is movement towards Democrats overall in the national environment, for the Senate picture to go from like, oh, actually it would be kind of hard for Democrats to retake the Senate, to, oh, actually, they have a ton of routes to retake a Senate majority. There are just so many races that Republicans are defending that, you know, Arizona, Colorado, Maine, North Carolina, you know, those are all going to be super close, presumably. Georgia, Iowa, Kansas, Montana, you know, those are reddish leaning, but they're feasible, right? And then Democrats are defending a couple seats. Alabama will be tough for Democrats. Michigan might be tough. But, you know, they look pretty safe in the others. There's just, they have a ton of opportunities this year.
So, Nate, because you're not going to tell me which party is favored, that's totally fair. We'll wait for the model. My question would be kind of more specifically, if you had to rank those states that Micah just mentioned, so North Carolina, Arizona, Colorado, and Maine to begin with, and then Georgia, Iowa, Kansas, Montana, more at the margin, which do you think are most likely to flip for Democrats, would be most likely to flip for Democrats?
I mean, I think Colorado is probably the single easiest pickup for Democrats. Cory Gardner's not very popular. John Hickenlooper, despite his less than spectacular presidential campaign, is popular in Colorado. He's way ahead in polls there in Colorado at this point as a relatively blue state. you know, I think Susan Collins' numbers in Maine have fallen enough where that might be the second easiest pickup for Democrats. McSally in Arizona, Canada, who already lost, right, in a similar environment, kind of in 2018, might not be in great shape. You know, Democrats are behind in this Alabama race with Doug Jones, and that's going to be a tough seat to defend in a presidential year when you're not running against someone who is accused of what Roy Moore was accused of. But it's a little bit, I mean, the problem is, like, I bet if you model the distribution, you get kind of this tail. It wouldn't be that symmetric, right? If Democrats are winning the generic ballot by 8 points or more, 10 points or 12 points, then that's a national landslide. And there are plenty enough opportunities where in a landslide type year, even though things are getting more partisan, but in a landslide type year, you start to win some places where you're not expecting to win necessarily. You know, these two seats in Georgia might be an example, for instance.
And to be clear, the generic congressional ballot right now shows Democrats 8 points ahead on our 538 tracker. So that's kind of the environment that these polls are based off of.
And that's a 2018 type environment. It ended up at about 8.5 or 9 points in 2018. It's at 8 points now. And so that would indicate that that's a wave type of environment where, you know,
yeah,
where Republicans would be on the defensive. Although, again, remember, Democrats could need four seats and not three if Doug Jones loses, which Doug Jones could easily lose, as a number of red state Democrats did, Heidi Heitkamp or whatever, even in a wave type year.
I think also if you're looking at, like, you know, like the Cook Political Report race ratings, in the lean Republican column, you already see, you know, I already see two races in Loeffler's Georgia race and Montana, the Dane seat, where those are like kind of interesting pick-offable races. Kelly Loeffler, the Republican senator from Georgia, was embroiled in the Senate, you know, stock selling scandal at the beginning of the pandemic. That's kind of like, you can see sort of some easy ads being made there. Steve Bullock, the popular Montana Democrat, is running for that Senate seat. That's good news for you know, Senate Democratic strategists. Also good news is the fact that Democrats are running with Joe Biden as their candidate and not Bernie Sanders. I mean, I remember talking to strategists in that weird period where it was not entirely clear who the Democratic nominee was going to be. And if you're talking to people who, you know, work for governors or who are working on Senate campaigns, they, you know, throwing ideology to the side from a pure strategic, we'd like to win state races point of view, most of those people wanted Joe Biden to have the nomination. So I think that that's a huge boon to a lot of these, you know, races on the margins.
It really does remind me a lot of 2018 in terms of the polling. In terms of, you're seeing, you know, a lot of Democrats, incumbents, and challengers outraising their Republican opponents. But again, to go back, the key difference is, like, okay, 2018 was a Democratic wave year, but it happened that the seats that happened to be up in the Senate formed like kind of like a, you know, a breaker wall, and then there were dunes, and then, you know, the wind was blowing off the mainland. So like that wave was pushed back a bit and never got that far up in terms of the Senate, right? A lot of those aren't in place for Republicans in 2020. And so if the generic ballot, to use that as our proxy for the national environment, is where it is now or higher, then I do think the Democrats have a really, really good chance of taking back the Senate, which, to Claire's point, back after Nevada, when it looked like Bernie Sanders might win the nomination, that seemed more far-fetched. And who knows? Maybe in 2-3 months, it'll seem far-fetched again.
Yeah, and with the regular caveats that we're in an environment that is, you know, more uncertain than 2018, for sure, given that we're in the middle of a pandemic. And Jeffrey Skelly, our colleague, also put out a piece on our website today kind of looking at how stable the generic congressional ballot is during an election year. And we've seen that it's moved significantly. So, right, people shouldn't be looking at the generic ballot today and thinking that we're on a 2018 repeat track. I think, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I meant by, you know, it might seem implausible again in 3 months. But saying there's a lot of uncertainty is not the same thing as saying sort of like looking at the current picture is meaningless, right? If you think that Republicans are looking at the generic ballot and saying, sure, we're down by 8, but there's a lot of uncertainty, you're kidding yourself, right? They're looking at that number and being like, holy shit, what are we going to do?
Yeah. I mean, because we're not even going to get to this topic right now, but they're also thinking about state house races, because those state legislators are going to be drawing the congressional maps for the next 10 years. And like, that's big time for the people who are in the trenches of state politics.
Yeah, look, I mean, we've barely mentioned the president. But, you know, views of number one, whether Trump wins or loses, will
who is it again?
Senate
seat. Wait, who is the president?
This podcast doesn't talk about Trump enough.
Donald J. Trump.
I forgot.
But yeah,
thanks.
First of all, which party controls a vice presidency could be relevant, right? It's one more seat you have to pick up or not pick up if you're Democrats. And secondly, yeah, I mean, look, people are always afraid to talk about, like, I mean, Mike, I think we talked about this the other week, right? The fact that there's uncertainty doesn't necessarily mean that it's close, right? Uncertainty could also involve a landslide against Republicans up and down the ballot, or a landslide against Democrats. But right now, the polls are pretty good for Democrats. So, you know, so the range of uncertainty probably runs from actually Republicans hold everything to it gets really bad for Republicans, and then you would have a potential landslide. But like, that's not a crazy possibility. And you're correct to point out that, like, if that were to happen, then the timing is bad for Republicans because of redistricting. Although I guess with the census partly delayed because of coronavirus, then there are some uncertainties there as well. But yeah, look, I mean, you know, uncertainty runs in all directions. And to me, that would just mean that if I were either party, that I would want to have a big playing field. I would want to, for both parties, defend seats that I might think would be safe.
Spread
the field. And I want to have candidates who are plausible nominees or plausible senators and governors and representatives in places that you might think seem out of reach, right? I think parties rarely go wrong by having a broader range of both defensive and offensive targets.
Nate, would you say you miss 100% of the shots you don't take?
You miss 100% of the shots that you don't take. Wayne Gretzky, folks.
All right. On that, we're going to wrap things up. So thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you, Galen. By the way, every time Nate said landslide in the last 5 minutes, I just pictured Stevie Nicks singing it.
Landslide, brought it down.
I think of the Dixie Chicks.
That anyway, too. That's a good version,
different
too.
Different brain. Two different brains. And thank you, Micah.
You're welcome.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.